Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. It is Friday, April 6, 2012, and you're listening to Mushing Radio on KVRF FM in Palmer, Alaska, 89.5. And you can also hear us streaming on radiofreepalmer.org and a podcast on mushingradio.com. We have our Iditarod co-host on tonight. He's joining us from Southern California, Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for joining us on a Friday evening. I don't know what you have planned down there in sunny California, but up here it's pretty nice in Willow. We got a lot of melt going on, but it's beautiful weather up here.
Excellent. There is nothing I would rather do than be on the radio with you and our guest tonight.
Very good, very good. So with that, let's introduce our guest. We're going to continue our Iditarod Musher coverage. We've been doing it for the last couple of weeks. We've interviewed Anna Barrington as well as Zoya Denure, and we have a show coming up very soon with 2012 Iditarod champion Dallas Seavey. But without further ado, everybody knows this lady who's going to be on today. Her name is Dee Dee Genro. Dee Dee, how's it going this evening?
Good, yeah. We are definitely in the throngs of melt, except for that straight outside my window, the snow is still all the way up to the windowsill.
You know, I know it. We have probably 4 or 5 feet still to go here. We just live a little bit south of you over by Vern Halter's place, so I know exactly what you're talking about those drifts in the front window there.
Yeah, yeah. It's going to be a while before I see my lawn.
So, well, thank you very much for joining us. As I said, you were contacted by Aaron McLarnon, the Iditarod Communications Director, and I want to appreciate everything that you guys are doing together on the Iditarod and joining us on Mushing Radio. If you will, Dee Dee, everybody knows who you are if they follow dog sledding at all, but for the novice fans out there that may not know who you are, can you introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about you.
Well, I started running dogs in 1979 when I was living in Western Alaska out of Bethel, and I've been just completed my 30th Iditarod. I've got 15 top 10 finishes, twice second place, and have a kennel of about 80 dogs at about 75 miles north of Anchorage, and raise and train my own dogs, retire my own dogs, and in addition to sled dogs, I also work with a Pekingese that's a therapy-rated dog and some Labrador Retrievers that, a couple of them that I've trained to do therapy work, and they do some service work, and they don't hunt, but they do a lot of other things.
Very cool. And Alex, be sure just to chime in if you have questions or comments for Dee Dee. We don't have any way of raising hands here on the radio, but definitely chime in if you have some comments. Okay, Alex?
I sure will. And I know that Dee Dee might be might not want to blow her own horn a little bit too much, but I also wanted to add that she did have 11 top 10 finishes in a row and has won numerous awards, including the Leonard Sepulveda Humanitarian Award that I believe you've won twice, including this past year.
Yes, I did. I just was really very honored to be awarded it by, it was a staff of 51 veterinarians that worked the Iditarod this year, and they chose me for that, and to me that's a huge honor since really, as far as I'm concerned, it's all about quality of life for the dogs.
Exactly, exactly. And if we can, Dee Dee, if we can focus on this show, you know, we talk to a lot of people on here about mushing and you know, what they're doing for the sport and how they did this year. But, you know, I would really like to pick your brain if we can, because you're the preeminent Iditarod veteran in terms of women mushing in the Iditarod and in the sport in general. And I'd like to focus on that if we can a little bit today, because you have to be the ambassador for women mushing, at least in the Iditarod, don't you think?
Well, you know, probably for longevity I am, because, you know, it's, I mean, other than Rick Swenson, nobody's been on the Iditarod trail longer. Martin and I share the same rookie year together in 1980. And, you know, considering there's been 40 Iditarods and I've run all but 10 of them, I would say that probably gives me a little longevity.
You know, I totally agree. You know, I was only 9 years old when you started running the Iditarod, so I am very familiar with your progress throughout the years. And you know, at least from a woman's perspective, you have to be the front runner in terms of you know, running this race and being the ambassador for the sport. But if I can, Dee Dee, how does it help or hurt you having all that longevity and experience on the Iditarod Trail?
Well, of course, you know, I think experience is sometimes a two-edged sword. You know, I was thinking about that this year when people were talking about different sections of the trail, that if you've never run the trail before, you may not be fearful of it. However, if you've run it as many times as I've had, you've seen a lot of things go wrong. You can sometimes garner up a lot more concern for things in your mind, because somewhere along the line, you know, there was no snow at that particular part, or the trail was water was open, or, you know, things that can go wrong. And, you know, inevitably it's always something different each year. For instance, the people that ran as rookies this year have, in as far as I'm concerned, no idea how bad the Delzell Gorge can be. I've seen that gorge much, well, I don't know if I've ever seen it safer than it was this year. I've seen it much more dangerous and in much worse conditions than what we had on the trail this year. And you might seem to think that all of our concern over the years in the gorge were drummed up, if you were only judging it based on the snow conditions we had out there this year.
Right, right. Alex, do you have a comment on that?
Not specifically on that, but I was wondering, Dee Dee, since you've run the race since 1980, what are the biggest changes that you've noticed, either in the trail or in the way the Iditarod is run since that time?
Well, there's been lots of changes. I mean, first of all, there was no dog numbers when I first ran. We could run as many dogs as, you know, you felt comfortable having in line. And at one point, you know, Bud Smith took 32 dogs, and that's when we put a limit on 20 dogs. And for years, we ran 20 dogs after that. And I don't even remember the year that we went to 16. And when we went to 16, the idea was that we were going to slow the race down, that it was too fast, you know, with our 20-dog teams. And, of course, that's been exactly proven to be untrue. You know, it was all the speed records have been set with the 16-dog limit. So, you know, that was an interesting idea. And, you know, I think it goes to give some validity to the idea that you're only as fast as your slowest dog. And to try to put 20 well-matched dogs together was really much more difficult than putting 16 together, and 16 well-matched dogs were faster than 20 dogs. And so, you know, that was one of the big changes that I've seen over the years. Of course, the sled types, you know, when I first ran, Tim White just had come out with the Toboggan. It was just a year or two earlier than that he had come out with the Toboggan style sled. And of course, we've, you know, greatly changed the shapes of sleds, designs of sleds, flexibility of sleds, material sleds are made out of, the weight of our plastic in the early years. In 1980, we screwed it on and countersunk those screws in the bottom of our plastic. And in fact, Herbie Nyakpuk in 80 ran on ivory runners. And, you know, he was a full 24 hours to 36 hours ahead of me on his ivory runners. And, you know, of course, nowadays we're on P-Tex and all sorts of different kinds of plastics, and plastics of all different colors for all different snow types. And I don't know if sometimes we don't complicate the issue, but still, you know, we have a lot of changes, and we certainly can change our runners a lot faster than we could back in those days.
You know, speaking of sleds and equipment, it's very interesting to watch some of the old videos from the mid to late 80s about what you guys are wearing out there. It looks like you guys are, you know, back then you were buying clothes right off of the rack at the Sports Authority or whatever the equivalent was back then. And nowadays everything is so high tech and expensive and, you know, specially made for those conditions. How has it changed for the musher and what you guys go through, at least from an elements respect in terms of clothing and gear and that sort of stuff for you guys?
Well, my stuff was bought off the rack, sure enough, but it was bought at Army-Navy Surplus, and I think the biggest issue I had was fit. You know, I had to, it was difficult for me at 5'2", 120 pounds, to find anything that was nearly durable enough to be worn in those conditions. And so I often wore things that were way too big for me, walking around on the, cuffs of my pants and kind of entrapped in clothing that didn't fit at all. And, that was my huge difficulty with it. And so, you know, over the years, I've been able to find clothing that actually was made for me, that, you know, the legs were the right length and the crotch was in the right place and didn't come down around my knees and trap me in my clothes. And, that has been huge for helping me be able to deal with the elements. But I got to say, I actually have gone back to some of the technology that was from the old days from the coast for my clothing, because my stuff is made so that it fits me, but it is from the insulation and technology other than Gore-Tex that came from the coast and from the native people themselves. Because after I went through chemotherapy and had, you know, a lot of the issues that I did through my cancer treatments, I could not stay warm. My whole metabolism had been so messed up that I had to actually ask the ladies on the coast, how did they stay warm? You know, they were elderly ladies that were standing out on the ice at 40 and 50 below wind chill, and they were watching sled dog races, and, you know, they seemed to be able to survive quite well in those conditions. And so, I actually went back to a fur liner inside my clothing for when the wind is blowing, and I've actually gone back to some of the old technology.
Very cool. Alex, you have something to say on that one?
Dee Dee, since you mentioned your battle against cancer, I think a lot of people know that you are a cancer survivor and that you were, I believe, diagnosed in 2002 and underwent surgery and treatment. And what many people who are longtime fans of the sport know is that you actually ran the 2003 Iditarod just a few weeks after you finished your last round of chemo. And I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about that and about that race in particular.
Well, I think 2003 is probably one of my most significant races in my career. And, you know, my finish was 18th. I mean, I think it's miraculous I finished, much less that I was able to finish in the top 20. And a lot of that speaks to that relationship and partnership that you have with your dogs, because I chose the older dogs that I had raced with in the past and that understood me. And I honestly believe that finish was a credit to my leaders that year. Ivan and Trotter just took miraculous care of me. And I think one of the things that did also contribute to me being able to finish that year was the fact that for the first and only time in the race's history, we actually, the rivers were so unsafe and open down below the Alaska Range that we had to restart the race in Fairbanks, north of the Alaska Range. And so we didn't actually go through the gorge. And I'm not sure in retrospect if I would have had the upper body strength to have been able to have handled my sled through the gorge. But I was able to handle the weather and the conditions, and we had quite a few teams that scratched that year. And yet, because of my team, you know, and I really give the credit to my team, I was able to not only finish, but be competitive at a certain level in that race.
Yeah, and I believe you were voted most inspirational musher that year as well.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I hadn't really thought about it. But, you know, for me, that race was significant in that it showed that all of the stuff they'd done to me, all the cutting and, you know, infusions and all the treatments and stuff, you know, I was still going to be able to have my life. And I got to tell you, there were a lot of times that winter when I was just, well, it was in January, I ended up in the emergency room with a, blood clot in my lung. And, you know, I wasn't sure that I would ever have my life back. And I knew it wasn't going to ever look exactly like it did. But if I could only have the things that made it worth getting off the couch for, if I could only have my dogs back, if I could only have my love of the out of doors back, but the neuropathy I had in the soles of my feet and in my hands in particular were so painful, I wasn't sure that any of that would be, you know, available to me. I didn't know what this was going to look like. And the mere fact that my competitors were awesome, absolutely awesome, so encouraging. And, you know, like I said, my dogs were so incredible. And it was through those conditions that I went to the native people of the coast and said, how am I going to do this? You know, how can I do this? And, you know, we got otter gloves, and I got, like, I'm using Tuscany lamb as the liner for the inside of my cuspuck, and I use a long cuspuck with a wolverine skirt on it to keep the wind and snow from coming up under my coat so much. And, you know, it's just a lot of things that I received help from the people that are, you know, have generationally lived in that environment.
And such an inspirational story there, Dee Dee, with you know, your fight and how you've overcome that. How is it now, 9 years later? You've put that behind, so to speak, and you're continuing on. You know, you've done a heck of a lot more racing since then. If we could fast forward to this year's race in 2012, how did that compare to those early races? Even that 2003 race, where you were having those difficulties with your health, compared to now, you know, 9 years later?
Well, I've got a lot more energy than I had. My energy level was really, you know, I would really get tired. I mean, so tired it was hard to think. And, of course, you know, there's people that, you know what I mean when I say chemo brain. It's a short-term memory fog that, you know, comes with the chemicals that they've infused you with. And I had a lot of infusion. My treatments didn't go real textbook-like. And so, you know, I know now that it took a long time to metabolically discharge a lot of the things that had happened to you. But, you know, it took a long time, but I got better and better and better. And this year was my best year since then, my very best year. And I think there's something encouraging with that, because it goes to show that even 9 years later, I am significantly stronger than I was right after treatment. So for those who have maybe been going through treatment or have maybe gone through it just a few years ago, no matter what your activity level is, and you maybe might be discouraged, because I was discouraged. There were times I was thinking, this, you know, they said, okay, there you go, off and running. And I'm thinking, with this body, yikes, this is not who I used to be. This is not it. And I was discouraged, you know, and then people would say, well, you know, you are getting older. And I'd go, oh, I don't think I age that much this fast. You don't understand. Maybe I can't explain to you what it feels like to be inside of this, you know, contraption that I'm in right now. And I just kept trying harder and trying harder and listening to other people that, you know, had been through it. Some people give up and they give in to that new set of circumstances that they're sent home with. And I can see why they do, because there's very little information out there that tells you how long it's going to take. And if you keep fighting and if you keep asking for that level of energy, and, you know, you'll never be the same, but you can be pretty doggone competitive and good again. But it takes a long time. And so I hope that if anybody gets anything out of my story, it's that don't settle. Just keep pushing ahead. Keep forging ahead. There's better times ahead, and there are. And here I am this many years later, with, you know, still in the competition, still a force to be reckoned with, still not to be dismissed. And I just think I'm getting better.
I think so, too. You did great this year, and I have to congratulate you. You guys put on a heck of a fight. You know, we were talking about the women mushers, and you and Allie Zirkel and all the folks in that that top-tier group this year. Man, you guys were putting a heck of a fight up against the guys, and you had a heck of a lot of hooting and hollering on Facebook for you guys. And man, I think that before too long, one of you ladies is going to take the crown. And you're going to have so many cheers from so many years of you guys, you know, being there but not quite making it. Do you think that's coming up pretty soon, Dee Dee? What do you think of the future in terms of women mushing in the Iditarod?
Well, I think so. I really do. You know, of course, I've been fighting on that door for quite a while, and I continue to pound on it. You know, Allie was second this year. I've been second twice. You know, you don't always go from second to first. I can tell you that from experience. But I can tell you that when you've learned how to break that top five, when you've been in the top 10 and pounded on that door as many times as I have, you know, any one year can be your year. You know, I really believe that. And there's Jesse Royer, who wasn't in the competition this year but has been the past several years and in the top 10. Allie, that's been in the top 10. Myself, that's been in the top 10. You know, there's three drivers right there that are serious competitors that I think, you know, any one year, if things went right, could win this race.
Alex,
yeah,
we've
talked a lot about how there's probably a group, in any year, there's probably a group of 12 to 15 teams that, given the right circumstances, the right dog health, the right driver health, the right weather, and a bunch of random factors, there's probably, in any given year, at least that many people who have a really good chance of winning the race. And you certainly, I would say, have almost always been up in that group.
I agree. I absolutely agree. And, you know, I know this year the press had a tendency to do the old-timers against the young-timers, you know, kind of a competition thing. I don't know if I totally agree with that, but I think the number of competitive younger drivers that are in the competition, as Dallas proved this year, as Pete Kaiser proved, as, you know, some of our other drivers are competitively knocking at the door, you know, that just goes to show how healthy the sport is. And I'm thrilled to see that there are that many good teams. You know, of course, I've got this thing where, boy, it was nice back in the years when there was really only 8 or 9 of us that were ever going to be in the top 10. And, you know, you could pretty well be sure of one of those positions. And that's certainly not the case anymore. There's a lot more teams that are right there, you know, knocking at the door, or if you make a mistake, going to gobble you up. But that means the sport is healthy. And that's really speaks well for the future.
And I would definitely like to spend some time on that in just a few minutes, Dee Dee. That was one of the topics I wanted to mention in this show. And we're talking to Dee Dee Genro, Iditarod veteran, 30-time Iditarod veteran here on Mushing Radio. Dee Dee, if I can ask a question here, since we do have you on as you know, a three-decade, four-decade now veteran of the sport, if I can, what does it take, if you can describe it for our listeners, what does it take for that team to get over that hump, to be a very competitive team? You often see, you know, a lot of the guys, the middle of the pack guys, the back of the pack guys, they're there all the time. And some of them are perfectly content with being there. They just want to get out. They want to do the race. They want to finish. You know, they have that goal in mind every year. But if you can describe it, what does it take in terms of dog care, I don't know, money, sponsorships, I don't know what, to break that barrier to be that top competitive team?
Well, you have to be focused and totally dedicated. It can't be a part-time job. It's a full-time. And even though I doubt hardly anybody does only racing as their only income. I don't know of anybody that can afford to do that. We all have to finance our races in some other manner. So we all are, there's as many ways to finance our races as there are drivers on the race. And, you know, myself, I do speaking engagements, and I work at other jobs. And my husband's a commercial salmon fisherman in Bristol Bay. We have numerous other things that we do. We're entrepreneurs, if you will, of multiple things to try to finance our, you know, my racing efforts and keep my kennel going. I know other people are, you know, do construction work. Alaska lends itself to seasonal workers. And so, you know, there's lots of other people that have tour operations, different ways that they finance their racing kennels. But those that are the competitive ones, the ones that are constantly knocking on the door, are the ones that are thinking about racing 365 days a year. They're constantly thinking about their team. They're constantly thinking about what kind of equipment things they can change, what kind of training things are going to change up. Just exactly, it's about the details that don't necessarily cost money, but they require mental discipline. And that's the person that you see climb out of the middle of the pack into the top of the pack. Those people that are constantly thinking about it. Their nutrition is on their mind 365 days a year. They don't take a break from dog care in the summer. They don't put their dog team on a maintenance diet. Their dog team is constantly on high-quality nutritional ingredients. They may be at a lesser amount of ingredient because they don't want their dogs to turn into two-tone Tonys, you know, but they are always giving them quality ingredients. They never forget to worm their dog team. Vaccination schedule is absolutely a routine. You know, their pups are raised in the cleanest environments because they race today on what they ate 6 months ago. You know, I remember that as an absolute rule of thumb 30 years ago. You know, and it would back when I was raising dogs in the village, and they would say, oh, yeah, they just feed them fish and rice in the summer. And then, you know, they start feeding them something, you know, that they want to race them on in, November, December. And, you know, it was like, nope, that's not metabolically how it works. The muscle mass that they're trying to raise on today was what they ate 6 months ago. You know, it takes 6 weeks for the enzymes in their stomach to adjust to a change of diet and be able to completely digest and metabolically use the ingredients that you're putting in their stomach. So, I mean, there's lots of that, those kinds of rules of thumbs that the drivers that go from the middle of the pack to the top of the pack take note of. And I'm particularly fond of Peter Kaiser. His parents were friends of mine when I first started running dogs. His mother was at my wedding 35 years ago, and before he was ever, a gleam in his parents' eye, his family was special to me. And to watch Pete come on the scene, serious, he made up his mind and he became serious, and he became quickly, by my standards, very quickly, a force to be reckoned with in the racing world. And that's because that boy is serious, he's focused. He doesn't have a huge dog lot, but what he has, those dogs were picked with care. He breeds with care. He studied under Ed Eaton up in Kotzebue, and he watched the Cusco because he had access to the Cusco, and he saw what he was interested in doing, and he was very focused. And he's a good example of how you can go from, you know, just getting into the sport to being a force to be reckoned with in the sport in a pretty short time. And he didn't do it generationally like Dallas did, where he had exposure to the sport and a good dog lot and a lot of dogs, you know, through the years. But Peter came onto it, you know, his dad had a recreational team, nothing like what Pete has done, but his dad was there 150% supporting him. And it's really fun. And there's another young driver getting ready to come up on the scene. You've seen him in some of the preliminary races. You're going to see him in Iditarod next year. And he's also coming out of the Bethel area. And that's Richie Deal. And Richie is a good friend of Pete's. And I got a chance to race with him in the Paul Johnson race, 450 out of the coast in February. And I'm very impressed. Lots of energy, lots of positive. I really like the way he is with his dogs. I think he'll be another force to be reckoned with as soon as he's able to get his rookie year behind him.
Alex, you have something to say on that?
Dee Dee, you were talking about dog care, and I just wanted to I know that you were one of the founders of Mush with Pride in the early 90s, and I was wondering if you could speak just a little bit about that organization and its founding and what the goals were.
I was a big supporter of it, but really I want to give credit where credit's due, and that was to Susan Butcher and David Monson. You know, they really saw the vision of let's teach, let's give a handbook, let's put it out there, let's use the peer pressure of success and try to give people the tools they need to be able to, because, you know, sometimes people just don't know, and it's ignorance is the reason that their dog care maybe is compromised. Sometimes it's, you know, lack of information, and we tried to come up with a tool that would make that information available to anybody, And see, you know, those guys were located on the road system at that time, and I was had just moved in on the road system. And when I say that, in Alaska, a great deal of Alaska is not accessible by road. And, you know, my early mushing years, I was living in western Alaska where we were not accessible by road. And so my ability to share with other mushers, of course, we didn't have the internet or anything like that, you know, was only when they came to races or I was at a race where, you know, drivers would come together. And basically that was the Cusco and then the Iditarod, where those drivers that were on, I remember being so excited that I was now on the road system and I could put my dogs in a truck and I could go and I could visit people and I could run all different places and I could travel in the middle of the night and I didn't have to buy a plane ticket every time I wanted to go somewhere. And it was just one of the most exciting things that, you know, I remember that when I first moved in, was just thrilled with the access to other drivers and the information that they had. And see, that was what Mush with Pride was. The whole idea was to try to get access to information so that we could up the quality of care everywhere, from recreational to skeeter teams to junior mushing teams to serious sprint teams and long distance teams, because basic dog care is the same for one dog or for 100 dogs.
That's a great point, and I think if a lot of people could understand that it is. It's pretty much, if you can take care of one dog and you take care of him or her very well, it is the same way if you're doing one or 80. That same amount of care has to be the exact, you know, that diligence has to be there. Don't you agree?
I totally agree. And, you know, I know that you see us and it looks so romantic in March when we're all in our colorful clothes and our beautiful booties and coats and, you know, we're out racing. But that's the circus, you know, that's the cream of the crop. What you don't see is the dedication that's there this time of year when the mud starts coming out. You don't see that we change straw every couple of weeks. This year we changed straw every time the temperature warmed up because it would snow and our straw would get wet. And you can't let a dog be in a moist bedding because then they could get some kind of a staph infection and or it's not healthy for their coats. And so we were constantly changing straw and we were constantly you know, shoveling things out and moving their houses. I have my houses mounted on their poles so that they move up as the snow gets deeper, so that I constantly keep their housing warm and up above the snow level. And in addition to that, we insulated the floors of our houses so that there wouldn't be a loss of heat through the bottom of their doghouse and, you know, in the into the snow or the ice, is whatever would be the case. And, you know, so this time of year, the summertime when other people go on vacation and they take off for places, that's when you see the real drivers that are dedicated. Those are the drivers that you generally see in the top of the racing circuit in the springtime of the race year.
We're talking to Dee Dee Genro on Mushing Radio. You can check it out on mushingradio.com and check out our Facebook page as well. I know you can visit Dee Dee's website. It's DeeDeeGenro.com. Are you on Facebook and everything else too, Dee Dee?
I am. I'm on Facebook. For anybody that's requesting to be friends, I guess I need to do a fan page or something because I'm maxed out. I've got 5,002 friends, and they keep telling me I got to drop two. I think 5,000 is the max, but just keep at it. I'll do something. I'll get some, but I do try. I have a race report from this year on my web page, and I try to be responsive to as many people as I can. And
Dee Dee, are you still there?
Yeah, I am.
Okay, you cut out there just a second. I apologize for that. If we can, we have about 10 minutes left, Dee Dee. We're talking to Dee Dee Genro and Alex Stein here on Mushing Radio. I want to find out what you think is the sport or the state of mushing. On our very first show, right before the Iditarod, we had Greg Sellotin on, the publisher of Mushing Magazine, and we talked about what he thought the state of mushing was at this point here in 2012. And we started the show off talking about your first Iditarod in 1980, and here we are 32 years later, and you're still going strong, as well as a lot of other guys are still doing very well when you think of Dan Seavey, who ran this year, Jim Lanier, and the really old-timers that are running in the Iditarod many years later. How do you see the state of mushing as a sport here in 2012 with the advent of social media and everything that's going on, you know, the insider with GPS and how people are following the races this year? What do you see it in the next few years in terms of the sport?
Well, I think I see the sport exploding. Personally, I wasn't really a big fan of the concept of trackers, but after I have had the thrill, if you will, of watching some of the races, Yukon Quest in particular, and some of the other mid-distance races that have used the spots and the tracker, most of the time I'm racing, so I didn't realize how actually exciting it is to hit that refresh button and know where my guys were and know where, you know, I'm a huge fan. I'm a big race junkie, and I found myself addicted and up in the middle of the night hitting that refresh button, wanting to know where drivers were in these other races that I was not entered in. And I got to say that I think that that has added a great deal of excitement and has made the it's so that fans around the world can follow you, and I think that's just going to increase the fan base. And all of those things bring to it a great deal of excitement, and I think particularly will grow long-distance mushing because there is the thrill of the strategy and the length of time that you're on the trail and the different moves that are made and the opportunity for more things to happen and more unknowns. I personally find myself a big fan. I did the Alpirad. I've done staged racing, and I have actually done the Women's Rondi, and I have done lots of different kinds of racing, and I enjoy it all. I have to tell you, I enjoy every bit of it, and I do hope before I retire to run in Wyoming. I think the Montana-Wyoming race would be, the stage stop would be really thrilling. I would love to do that, and I would love to do the Yukon Quest. I just like all kinds of races. I thoroughly enjoyed the Paul Johnson's Memorial 450 race on the Kosciuszko in February, but I think long distance is really where my heart is, and one of the reasons is because you get to play with the dogs more. You get to sleep with them. You get to play with them. You get to massage them, and for me, that's the relationship with the dogs and the time that I spend cuddling and just snuggling in the straw and just talking to them about things and spilling my guts with my dogs. That's what the sport is for me. It's my relationship. It's why I've got 20 retired dogs in my kennel. It's why people, I just had some people visit the kennel today, and they said, well, are those dogs supposed to be loose? And I said, oh, yeah, they're the old dogs, and they're spayed and neutered, and they're all loose, and they just meander around and check things out, and they haven't been on a chain in 5 years. You know, they don't need to. They don't leave the property, and, you know, it's the quality of life and their experience through the entire life, not only racing career, but through their entire life, that is what's important to me. And so I have a senior citizen home, and I have, you know, young dogs. I only raise about a litter or so a year. I don't raise a lot of puppies. And I just keep my dogs, and so if I find a particular good pet home, I might let one of my older dogs go, or I might not, depending on the situation. But generally speaking, I think it's distance mushing that my heart is dedicated to, and consequently really long distance mushing, because the experience lasts longer. And because of those long, long hours on the trail and long careers that I have with my dogs, I think that you're going to find more and more people, as they discover that opportunity, finding themselves fans.
That's a great point.
Edie,
go ahead, Alex. I wanted to ask one final question, but go ahead for sure.
I was just going to say, Didi, that you are, I think, without a doubt, one of the best ambassadors for the sport that there is. Every time I have ever seen you, you are surrounded by a crowd of fans, and you are always very, very patient and very willing to share your experiences and your stories with people, and that is just a fantastic thing. And I think that that your dedication not only to your dogs and to spreading the good word about dog care, but also your dedication to the sport and wanting to share your love of the sport is something that really has just been amazing and has helped the sport grow, and I think will help the sport grow a lot in the future as well.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, it's nice to think that your life's passion is valuable to somebody because it is the relationship. You know, there's a lot of activities that I do on my own, but if I can't share them with a dog, I quickly grow tired of them. And so I found myself, for instance, I do trail racing instead of road racing because that's something I can take my dogs with and practice. And I hike mountains instead of, you know, trails that are close to the city because I can take my, you know, two or three, four dogs with me at a time. I float on rafts where Mike has made little porches so dogs can float with me. Everything's more fun if a dog can share the time with me.
That is very cool. And again, we're talking to Dee Dee Genro on Mushing Radio. Great interview. I really appreciate it. I just have one final question, Dee Dee. You know, a lot of fans of mushing and, of course, of most dog-powered sports have that, you know, that dream in their mind of one day making it up here to Alaska to run the Iditarod and, you know, to be a part of that. And I'm one included. I moved up here from Colorado, bought the house, the whole nine yards. But a heck of a lot of us are just the mushers that have, you know, two, three, four dogs in the backyard. They take them out on their scooters or on their little sleds in the wintertime. And that's probably, by and large, the majority of mushers, not only in this country, but in the world. Those very small kennels, those you know, mom-and-pop kennels, those backyards that have those two or three dogs. What could you tell to those guys, you know, to give them that one piece of advice that would really help those guys out that, you know, that just have that drive and determination to get out there and do it every day?
Well, first of all, I want to tell you that you guys are the backbone of the sport. We might be, you know, living the dream on the Iditarod Trail, but you guys are the backbone of the sport, and there are more dogs that have a better quality of life because of those kennels than there is any other single racing kennel. There can only be a smaller number of racing kennels. But how many dogs are getting the enjoyment of being able to do what God created them to do, to live an active lifestyle, to be athletically healthy, than the dogs that are being kept by the junior mushers and the working couple that, you know, can only run in the evenings and on weekends and, you know, go out and enjoy the trails and enjoy their dogs? The thing that I would say to you is, and that I really encourage everybody that's interested in any of our active breeds, and that is they are not stuffed toys. They are not just animals that you can come home once in a while and take a look at. They will frustrate you if you think of them in that regard. These are animals that they need to share the active part of your life with. And there's nothing they can't do. You can share them in the summertime and in the wintertime. There is no off season for those dogs. They love to run. They love to jog alongside you. They can learn anything you have the patience to teach them. The only thing that is a limiting factor on that is your patience, because I have yet to run into a dog that can't learn without you when you spend enough time with them.
Very, very good stuff. Alex, anything else to say in closing?
Well, you know, we don't really have enough time to get into it, but I know that a lot of fans of the sport, Dee Dee, know that you do a lot of things involving charitable work and raising awareness and raising money for cancer research and the Pause for Logan project that you had a couple of years ago. And I just want to thank you for talking to us. I think we probably could talk to you for hours and hours about all of the stuff that you've done. But I just wanted to thank you.
Well, thank you guys so much. Like I said, you know, it's so nice to see that your life's passion is useful. And Logan's project was one of those where I was just, I'm rewarded every time I see Juke working with Logan. That dog is incredible, and that relationship and how it's helped Logan to be able to operate better in life. He still has a long ways to go, but that dog is incredible. And that's a good example of, you know, a dog can learn anything you want to teach him. It's just how long are you willing to spend time teaching whatever it is it you have to learn. And I had a litter of Labradors, and one of my labs is a service dog and is an awareness for a diabetic, an elderly diabetic man. And, you know, just I love this 8 puppies, and I have a therapy dog, a service dog. I have one of them that's a great birding dog and hunting in North Dakota, just doing amazing things, you know, all of this from the same litter. And I'm just really fun to see dogs learn. I think the most difficult dog I've ever worked with is my current Pekingese. And he is therapy rated and he's service rated, but he's been one of the toughest nuts to train. But, oh, my goodness, how much fun it is for me to teach dogs things.
You know, Dee Dee, I appreciate it so much. I've heard you speak a couple of times at the last symposiums up here in Willow, and you're a tremendous inspiration, not only to our little community here of 2,000 or 3,000 folks that live here in Willow, but to everybody throughout the world. You are the preeminent ambassador for the sport, and I want to appreciate you spending the time with us today.
Absolutely, my pleasure, and I look forward to it in the future as well.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Dee Dee.
Good night.
That was Dee Dee Genro. DeeDeeGenro.com is her website, and check her out on Facebook as well. She'll make sure she can friend you as soon as she can, and she hopes to have a fan page up pretty soon. So definitely check her out on Facebook, if not on that website, DeeDeeGenro.com. So on behalf of our guest tonight, Dee Dee and Alex calling in from California, this is Robert Forto for Mushing Radio. We'll talk to you guys next time. Goodbye.